welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight, or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. All right. Welcome, Earth Explorers, once again to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from Western North Carolina. AccuWindow forecast is a little rainy outside, and that might be having an effect on our sound quality. So I'm not really sure what's going on. It's a mystery. Maybe the subject matter of what we're going to talk about tonight is just a little too controversial, and so the powers are out there messing with our modulation. The solar wind is a brisk 467.5 kilometers per second. Sunspot 1108 is still there and very large. However, it is quiet, and sunspot 1109 is also large and silent. Both are expected to remain stable, but we'll keep you posted. The Department of Defense recently purchased and destroyed thousands of copies of an Army Reserve officer's memoir, Operation Dark Heart, in an effort to safeguard state secrets, a spokeswoman said Saturday. Department of Defense decided to purchase copies of the first printing because they contain information which could cause damage to national security, Pentagon spokeswoman Lieutenant Colonel April Cunningham said. Lieutenant General Robert Burgess said the manuscript contained secret activities of the U.S. Special Operations Command, CIA National Security Agency. At least one seller on eBay is claiming to have a first edition printing. He's selling it for an asking price of $2,000. Wouldn't buy that one out of bed, would you? No. No. And if I did, I would buy it from a friend's address. Australia's Darling River is running with water again after a drought in the middle of the decade reduced it to a trickle. But the rains feeding the continent's fourth longest river are not the undiluted good news you might expect. For the cloudbursts also create ideal conditions for an unwelcomed pest, the Australian plague locust. The warm, wet weather that prevailed last summer meant that three generations of locusts were born, each one up to 150 times larger than the previous generation. After overwintering beneath the ground, the first generation of 2010 is already hatching. Following the wettest August in 7 years, the climate is again perfect for the little beggars. The juveniles will spend 20 to 25 days eating and growing, shedding their exoskeletons 5 times before emerging as adults when population pressure will force them to swarm. Wow. Locusts, frogs, next thing you know we're going to have boils. Maybe we're getting to the end times and we don't even know it. I thought this article might convince you that the U.S. government isn't the leader behind the newest optical satellite technology being placed into space. The administration of U.S. President Barack Obama objected to a provision in a Senate defense bill that would place restrictions on the kinds of commercial satellite imagery the Pentagon could purchase in the future, according to a September 21 White House statement. The Senate version of the 2011 Defense Authorization Bill, drafted in May, includes a provision barring the Pentagon from entering into new imagery purchase contracts after 2010 unless the satellites in question have a 1.5-meter telescope. Now, I need to tell you that 1.5-meter aperture is not that high of resolution, and it gets better. Quote, since the commercial satellite industry does not currently build 1.5-meter satellites, this provision would require considerable additional government investment and is not required to meet defense or intelligence requirements. Not required to meet defense or intelligence requirements, said a statement of administration policy posted on the White House's website. The stipulation is that GOI, that's the people that actually build the satellites, is going to build satellites with other apertures with greater resolution, but that the U.S. Pentagon can't purchase that technology. Who is purchasing the technology? And why would the Senate bill be addressing it and keeping the Pentagon out of the loop? Now they're down to 1.1 meter apertures, which means they can read even tighter and smaller things on the Earth than a 1.5 meter aperture would be able to do. Why would they be building satellites that do even more than what the defense and intelligence agencies need? Very interesting. Very interesting indeed. Want to let you know, Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, is now out in print. You can buy it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble Books, a million bar, Borders, Walden Books, everywhere fine books are sold. But if you want to buy it with an autograph, you can get it from rememberingthefuturebook.com. rememberingthefuturebook.com. If you buy it from me, you'll not only get the autograph copy, we will send you a bonus of the entire book in audio as a free download. Just go to rememberingthefuturebook.com and order yours today. As we near winter, and we're entering, obviously, into a period of weather unrest, if you've been listening to this program or have subscribed to our recent newsletter, you'll know that weather anomalies, actually extreme weather anomalies, are frequent all over the place. And we don't really understand what's going on, but we do understand that they are extreme. We're having extreme cold, extreme hot, extreme rain, extreme drought, and you might find yourself in a position to have to access emergency services. That is to say, you might need emergency food or water or water filter or medicine, at least basic first aid. We suggest that you go to 1-800-PREPARE.com. My good friend Paul Faust and his partner, who is an EMT, Paul Faust is a former firefighter, they saw a great need after 9/11. They saw that a lot of people ended up on emergency services that had no business being there. Plenty of resources. All they needed to do was get prepared, and there wasn't a good resource out there. Now, we researched dozens and dozens of emergency preparedness sites for you over the last 5 years, and we have found one and only one that will package, price, ship, and get these emergency services, not only information, but also food, and some of this stuff will last for 25 years. It's basically set it and forget it. Put it in a book bag by the front door, and don't worry about it, because it's going to be good for a quarter of a century. You can grab it and go and take care of yourself and not have to rely on emergency services. 1-800-PREPARE.com. On your way out of that shopping cart, if you'll put in the coupon code Brooks, B-R-O-O-K-S, you'll get an additional 10% off. What a deal. No tax, most of the time free shipping, and an additional 10% off if you put in the code Brooks. As you read Remembering the Future, you're going to be introduced to the Flower of Life meditation. Very efficient for a busy guy like me. If you're as busy as I am, I know you're going to do great things. You're going to need a form of meditation that's for busy people, and it's efficient. It gets things done. And it will get you where you can listen to the resonance of the universe, as is mentioned in our book. That guidance is best given by Master Teacher Maureen Saint Germain. You can find the link at rememberingthefuturebook.com. You can also find it at xsquaredradio.com, or you could just go to maureensaintgermain.com. M-A-U-R-E-E-N, Saint, that's S-T-G-E-R-M-A-I-N.com. Select the Merkaba 2 CD, and you'll have everything you need to unlock the secret of the law of abundance for yourself. Also, don't forget to click on the Web Talk Radio link at Expert Radio. These are short 30-minute programs. The more you click, the more your friends you send there, the better our chances are of syndication, and that means we get to play on the airwaves. So let's spread the word, because we need something positive out there. So, sorry about the fits and starts tonight. Those of you that are listening to the archive, we may include the fun and games as you listen to the archive. If you're listening from 8 to 11 on Sunday evening, September 26th, you're with us live, which means that you can call us. Our phone lines will be open all night, all 3 hours. If you're off-planet, you can reach a cell phone tower. It's easy enough, 530-413-4511. If you're east of Earth, it's 530-413-4515. And west of Earth, 530-413-4520. And if you're going to step out, you can listen to us on your cell phone by dialing 712-432-0075 and putting in the access code 318-116-POUND. All of this information is available if you click the Listen Live link at X Squared Radio. We'll be back in 40 seconds with our guest. Don't go away. We'll be right back with X Squared Radio.
The spice extends life. The spice expands consciousness. The spice is right on space travel.
Well, you have wondered. We have discussed many times the possibilities of origins, designs, alignments, and purposes of the Giza pyramids. What we have not discussed so much is the methods by which they were designed. What measurement system was used? What tools were shared so that distant suppliers could make impossible stones that would be used in the construction? What kind of arguments ensued between quarry masters and engineers? Our guest is a master woodcarver and woodworker with over 30 years of experience using the tools of the trade. Measure and geometry. As well, he has been a performing musician for over 30 years. Our guest tonight may have solved this riddle. His research is new. Yes, it has been looked at by the experts, which we will discuss tonight. But it is so exact and so perfect that it leaves the experts speechless and stunned in its simplicity and beauty. My guest tonight is going to present his ideas for the first time, and we will attempt to work our way through the complexity to the simplicity of the idea. Please welcome with me Ed Nightingale. Welcome to the program, Ed.
Could get a little bit more volume from you. I'm having a little hard time hearing you.
I'm not exactly sure why that is. We're having very difficult time with our internet connection tonight. We're throwing the airwaves out there. I just don't know why it's not making it all the way to Paradise, California, which is where the studio is, and for you to hear me. But you're also quiet to me. We'll just try to make the best of it tonight.
Okay, okay? I'll try to do the best I can there. So if I stumble a bit, I'll try to do the best I can here to hear you.
All right, very good. The tools used by the original creator of the pyramid are regarded as a straight edge and compass, and he who would attempt the task must be limited by the same constraints. The solution to the reconciliation of arcs and lines must therefore be governed by proportion. What did you discover about this, Ed?
Well, I discovered that basically encoded within the design of the pyramid complex itself, encompassing the nine pyramids and the Great Sphinx, that it was all done geometrically, and within the geometry there was mathematics. And I approached it that way, with that hypothesis. And I did find that there was indeed the geometry that worked out and decoded basically high mathematics and science encoded within it.
Well, let's try to get a little more detail here. When we talk about geometry, I mean, obviously, we're fascinated by the proportions of the pyramid, the perfection of the pyramid, and of course, the sheer scale of the pyramid. But one of the challenges that we've discussed many times here on this program with guests like Robert Balval and others is that when we believe the pyramid was built, there doesn't appear to be a uniform system of measurement. There was no universal language. There wasn't even a wheel or iron tools. And yet, there the pyramids sit, like a bumblebee that's not supposed to fly. How do we resolve this? I mean, how do we invent the possible here?
Well, what I think I found is actually they did indeed know measure, and whether it was all the Egyptians or not, I don't think so, but the priests and certain architects that put this together did very well understand measure, and it is encoded within the Giza template, as I discovered, and it comes right out to the understanding of the Egyptian cubits and how it relates to the English feet and inches as we know it today. So what they did essentially was encoded mathematics and science within the geometry of the complex. So this kind of hurts the theory that they did not know measure back then, or any consistent measure. One fact I think that they did, and it's based on the Egyptian royal cubit, and which is very well documented in the Great Pyramid itself. And my numbers that I've found work exactly with the numbers that are accepted by mainstream as far as the Egyptian royal cubit and the English inch. A lot of this work was covered by John Neal, who wrote a book called All Done with Mirrors. It's one of the foremost books on where metrology, or the science of measure, begins. They realize that the different systems of measures around the world are really all related back to two numbers, and these numbers are the royal cubit, the Egyptian royal cubit, and what they call the root cubit, these two numbers. So they've got the metrology figured out that far, but no one has ever been able to put their finger on where these numbers originate. And what I found within the geometry is literally the where we find measure. You know, why is a mile, and a foot, and all that. So that's some of the stuff that I found within that. So kind of, you know, the thought of that they did not have a system of measure back then is kind of thrown out the door with this information.
First of all, if we think about this from the roots of it, the pyramid, some believe, was built in, 3150 B.C. by the descendants of Noah.
Right,
the valley of Egypt, Egyptus, which was the wife of Ham, and then Egyptus, the daughter of Egyptus and Ham, entered into the valley of the Nile, which is now called Egypt. And it appears by at least dating everything there, that those structures could have been sitting there when they arrived. Some say they're 9,000 years old. Some say they're only, 150 years old. There's a big discrepancy there. The point being that where all the materials came from, as far north as Aswan and as far south as the Sudan, there really wasn't a standard system of measurement. So something had to be the standard. Something had to be the root thing that from which all measurements were derived. Like, for instance, in the metric system, we say it's the meter bar that is the basis, the root measurement for all the metric systems. But where did all these measurements come from? Is this what you discovered by studying the pyramid?
Yes, exactly. Where these numbers originate is what I've discovered. It's part of what I've discovered. There's many different facets to this whole discovery here, and it's really an ongoing discovery. I keep finding new things all the time as I work on it. But located actually within this geometry, as the geometry is broken down, it basically walks you through some basic mathematics. And after a few steps, you find that there's an actual musical scale within this information. It's a scale of fifth intervals in music that creates the music scale as we know it. And located actually in one of the intervals in this musical scale, in one of the intervals, if it's divided up by eight notes or seven intervals, all the numbers of that measuring system are encoded directly within this musical scale, exactly to the, you know, to the fraction of an inch. And these numbers are what start out the basic, that give the number for the root cubit, the standard cubit, and it gives it in inches, which ties it into the English foot, which the English obviously is, Johnny Come Lately's here. This is obviously way before the English were even around, but, so yes, it's all the numbers that make up the measuring system come out of a musical scale, a division of an interval of a fifth interval, and
what was the first note that the scale starts
with? The first note that contains the numbers in is 288 hertz, which is a D note. And if you were to go in a fifth interval from a D note in frequencies, you would multiply the 288, which the first note is, and you would multiply that by 1.5, and that gives you the next note, which is 432, and that's an A note. Now, 432 is obviously a recognizable number in the sacred numbers, the ohm, for instance, and, you know, in religion is the frequency that they chant. Is 432, this ohm, and that is actually when that number is divided. If you simply divide 432 by 21, you end up with 20.57142, and that is the number for the Egyptian root cubit, which then can be added. A fraction can be added to that, and you would obtain the 20.618 inches for the standard royal cubit, which the Great Pyramid is.
Why would you divide by 21?
Because 432 on the scale that starts out in a C, 432 is actually the 21st interval. Or note, I should say. Interval, I'm sorry, the interval. So the 432 is at the 21st interval, and if you divide the 432 by 21. You get the root cubic measurement.
Now that's
also,
what's the first frequency? So you start and then you have an interval and then you have another number and another interval. What's the first frequency?
The first frequency would be the 288. The next note would be an additional 20.57142 on top of the 288. That would be the next note. I don't have that written right in front of me here, but if you add the 288 and the 20.57142, that would be the first note in that interval between 288 and 432.
All right. You sent me a graph, and on the left-hand side, that would be the y-axis, you basically go from 1 to, what is it, 440?
It would be a doubling sequence down the left side of the graph.
Right. It's an 8 by 8. So you're going from 1 all the way to 256. And 256
correct.
Is...
And each one is doubled.
Widely accepted as middle C.
That's right. Correct. C. Correct.
So you go just the standard, like you would normally do in binary code, 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, 256. You just
correct.
Multiply it by 2, going down the left side. Now, another standard in music is if you take a musical string and you cut it in thirds, you will go up the scale. So across the top, you go 1, 3, 9, 27, 81, 243, 7, 29, 21, 87, 65, 61, each
correct.
Time dividing by 3. So you have these two standards, and it creates a grid. And where the grid intersects, when you draw a line between them, you get the scale. C, G, D, A, E, B, and F sharp and C sharp.
Yes.
So this is a linear movement, but it looks like they're using the frequency of sound to come up with these precise measurements.
Yes.
Very interesting.
Yes. Exactly.
Now, how does phi figure into this? You have the golden mean, this ratio of 1.618 to 1. How does this calculate into this growth sequence?
Well, in the original geometry that's on my website at the musictemplate.com, you can look and see that the basic geometry, I actually have a little video clip there that walks you through the basic geometry of how all this started. And the basic circular geometry essentially starts out with a circle. And divided up into proportions of the main diameter, and that would be a half of the diameter circle, a third of the diameter circle, and a quarter of the diameter circle. And when that configuration, when those four circles, you can imagine one whole circle, inside of it you have a circle that's half its diameter, and that is at the top, point toward the apex of the circle, toward the top. The one-third diameter is centered right in the middle, off the same axis as the main circle, and the quarter diameter is at the bottom. Now, with those four circles placed where they are, you are actually able to divide that circle into nine using some basic geometry, just using your straight edge and connecting a few points. You can literally divide the perimeter of the circle by 9. And once I realized that part of it, and I realized that these proportions worked within on a planned view of the Giza Plateau, that's a view looking down on the pyramids themselves, that these circles related directly to the placement of the pyramids. And it was from that basic geometry and the circles being in proportion 4 1/4 and 3 1/3 and 1/2 or 2, that 432 is directly in the geometry right there. You know, the one whole circle with a 4, a 3, and a 2 parked right in it. So that's how it all starts off. And what happens when you draw a 45-degree angle through that circle from its axis, you right away line up two corners of the two main pyramids in a complex, Khufu and Khafre. So as soon as that corner, the 45-degree angle, hits the corner of the pyramid of Khufu, that point right there divides a square that's the size of the circle. It divides that in its phi ratio point. So if you were to look at it's actually the southeastern corner of the pyramid of Khufu. That point of that corner of the pyramid, the Great Pyramid, is the point in the circle that makes up the phi ratio of the square of that circle.
So it's not only the construction of the Great Pyramid, it's the arrangement of the pyramids in the complex that completes this map. Measurement system.
Yes.
It sounds too precise to be random. One of the questions that Robert's an engineer as well as I am, and one of the questions that we run around with is that, you know, the designers of this said, well, we're going to need black granite from the Sudan, and we're going to need red granite from the Aswan, and it's going to be in this and these proportions. So I could see the designer knowing all this, that this is how it's going to lay out, this is the measurement system, we're not going to alter from it. And so the runner takes off down to the Sudan to get the black granite, and when he's asked, what are the dimensions you want in this granite, the runner would just sing or play certain notes, which we equated into link. No wonder it was repeatable.
Yeah. Yeah, and that obviously frequencies, that's exactly what we're talking about here, and you know how it would convert and be able to, for the guy at the quarry on the other end that knew what was going on, and they probably had a very good system of exchanging the information between the ones that needed to know. The ones in the field didn't need to know all these specifics, I don't believe. I think this is just, they were able to just communicate it with, you know, on a need-to-know basis as far as the details of the measure.
Yeah, and that's probably why the root of the measurement system didn't proliferate.
Right.
I guess the question is, how did the designers of the pyramid know about the speed of light and the wavelength of say 1 hertz at the speed of light, which is really distance over time? Where did they get this value from?
Well, that is a good question. Where they actually got this information from? There's different theories about that. The one I kind of tend to listen to anymore is pretty much what the Egyptians themselves had to say about that. And in Abydos, there is some hieroglyphs that state that the plans for the temple, this is a rough translation here, I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but the plans for the temple were sent down from the heavens in the time of Imhotep at Saqqara. That's basically the only thing that I've ever found that even discusses anything to do with the pyramids. It does make sense, because this work of mine actually even ties into Saqqara, and the cubit that Saqqara, the six-step pyramid in Saqqara, of the step pyramid Zoser, is created in the other root cubit, which is the 20.57142 length cubit. So the construction at Saqqara is in the first root number that I found, within, right within our scale. The second cubit, which is the standard royal cubit, is actually found. It's actually found within the scale as well. If you go up the scale to the next interval beyond 432 to 648, if you divide 648 by pi, and the pi that we're going to use for this all this discussion is the decimal equivalent of 22/7, which is what right. The Egyptians used. If you divide 648 divided by that pi, 24/7 pi, you get 206.181818, which is, if you just move a decimal point, it is the Egyptian standard cubit that the Great Pyramid is designed and built in.
That is so interesting. Yeah. You know, a lot of the current historians say that Saqqara was the oldest pyramid, and it was kind of a practice pyramid. That's why it was a step pyramid, and they learned enough about the engineering of it that they decided to build out of better materials and then build the Great Pyramid. There are other theories out there that say that the Great Pyramid was there first, and that when the, quote, Egyptians, or the predecessors to the Egyptians, came into the valley, they were so impressed by the pyramid that they tried to copy it, and that Saqqara was the first attempt at a copy, but they couldn't do it because the sheer weight of the pyramid was cracking it apart, and so they had to build it as kind of a step pyramid. And if you go there, and I suggest that you do, by the way, I want to let people know we have 4 seats left on our Egypt trip coming up the April.
Great.
Numbers.
I actually hope I can be over there, possibly with John West, set up around that time. We'll see about that. But I have been to Saqqara as well.
When we're there. What you will find when you look at the two pyramids is that Saqqara is a pile of mud bricks compared to the Great Pyramid. They're nowhere even close to the same level of workmanship. Not even close. What do you think about the theory that Saqqara might have been a copy of something that was already sitting there for thousands of years, and some egotistical pharaoh decided to copy it and make it into something, you know, even greater than Cheops?
Well, it's pretty interesting, you know, the age and all that. I actually was over to Egypt in 1997 with John West, and you know, did a tour with him and saw and looked at the erosion on the Sphinx and other places throughout the plateau, as well as Saqqara. There are water eroded areas there that John and Robert Schock, Dr. Robert Schock, are looking at and continuing to move forward on their work with that. But one thing I can say is that, you know, I have seen this water erosion with my own eyes, and I've seen it, and, you know, have to conclude along with Schock and West that, you know, these things are much older than what the Egyptologists are saying. Now, that doesn't say that, you know, it was wasn't rebuilt or reworked at some point. I mean, that's all a possibility. I keep an open mind on this until, you know, we can really get down to brass tacks and figure this out. But, you know, I have to lean toward the science, and the science of the geology is pretty hard to dispute there. And the fact that Dr. Robert Schock believes that one of the oldest spots on the plateau itself is right near the Pyramid of Khafre. He thinks is one of the oldest spots, which coincidentally happens to be the exact center of the circle that encompasses the geometry. Well, now here is the theory that it's designed.
You can look at Cheops and the Giza area, and you look at these two differences in workmanship. And then you travel to, say, someplace like Dendera, and you see what the Hathors built, and then where it was covered up and then expanded upon much later, hundreds of years later. And what you see is the same difference in workmanship. The ancient workmanship is wonderful.
Yes.
Is spectacular, smooth, flawless. But the much later, much more modern workmanship is really a pile of rubble in comparison.
Yes. That's very true. Even in the Cairo Museum, when I was there, walking in the front door of the museum, the Old Kingdom stuff is the first stuff you see on display. And some of the diorite bowls and vases that are clearly turned at an extremely hard material that only really diamonds could cut. Here you have these delicate vases that are hollowed out with real thin necks, and it's just absolutely amazing. And yes, to agree with you, the older the stuff there, the more unbelievable it is. What I think and what you can almost conclude from that is there was a higher knowledge that was slowly lost over a period of time.
Sure, it's like the difference between finding a fine ceramic vase and then handing that to a sixth grader and say, here, use this modeling clay and make a copy of this.
And
then what you see is, a regular piece of handcrafted clay compared to something that was carved out of solid crystal or out of solid ceramic. It's just amazing, the difference in tooling.
Yes,
if you go to places that most of the tourists don't go, like Abu Sir or Abu Ghraib or places like this, you will see workmanship that flaunts. It literally flaunts engineering.
Yeah.
We're talking about coping made out of alabaster that's curved and pointed like a knife edge. And these pieces are 6, 8, 10 feet long. Now, they don't have to build it this way. This is purely for looks, purely for aesthetics, not for fit or function, just the aesthetics of it. And yet you look at the engineering that it took to make that edge. I don't think that we could do it today. We could come close, but I don't think we could do it today. Not in that fashion.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And most people who really study this from an engineering standpoint will definitely agree. They were, in my opinion, they're using a technology that we're not. I say we, the public domain, is not in. Does not have access to. But I do believe that part of what is discovered within this template leads right down that road to, maybe how they were actually able to do what they were doing. Part of technology, just science.
It's one thing to say they used diamond dust, or they used a giant logger's saw that two guys could run back and forth while two guys sprinkled diamond dust in the crack, and that they sawed back and forth to saw a block off. That maybe I could believe that. But when you go and you see a piece of basalt that, we're talking black basalt, that's polished smooth, and it's a giant floor stone, and in the floor stone is machined a door hinge. And on that door hinge is a stone door that looks to have been 12 inches thick that turned on a basalt bushing, a raised part of the bushing that was literally machined out of that floor.
Mm-hmm.
So the door would be, 5/16 of an inch, 8 millimeters off the floor. So this stone door could be moved back and forth with a single hand, easily balanced, clearing the floor by 8 millimeters, like a normal a door would clear a piece of carpeting in your house, except that it's all one piece of basalt.
Yeah.
Now, basalt is some hard stuff. You can't even tool it with iron. How did they do that?
Yeah, that's the $64 million question here. And, you know, some of the work of Chris Dunn and others who have really looked at the, you know, the machining, the evidence for machining in the pyramid and around different, not just in the pyramids, but around Egypt, it's clearly, there's clear evidence of machine marks. They're obviously using machines. You know, any machinist who looks at this, just like Chris Dunn, you can see it, and anybody who really takes a look at it, you just cannot argue the fact that there's tool marks in this stuff. And, you know, that, I know throws another wrench in the works there for the, mainstream academic on this, but, my apologies. This is the fact, and, you know, we can't do it today. You're right. We can't even cut this stuff with, you know, some, you know, good iron stuff. And they obviously, according to the mainstream Egyptology, didn't have those tools. They were using copper chisels. Now, you know, I've seen them do the little dog and pony show, chipping away with a, on a piece of limestone with a copper chisel and telling us that's how they did it and all, but I want to see, you know, one of them, those chisels there make, you know, some of the things like you're talking about there. The tolerances that we're talking about in my business, I do high-end architectural millwork and carving, and we work to very close tolerances on our work. And I know what it's like to get a piece of wood to those tolerances using the latest machinery. And, you know, I can tell you that the theory of taking a copper saw and putting some sand in it, yes, you might be able to cut through a block of granite given a lot of hours, but, you know, I defy them to get it to the tolerances that we're talking about. The cutting it is one thing. Achieving the tolerances that they were is a completely different story. You know?
Yeah. If you walk around the Sphinx, you know, there it's kind of dug into the ground like a giant pit. But if you walk outside the grounds of the Sphinx to the north, there's a lot of just various stones and things that have to reassemble yet, and they're kind of laying around. You'll see some cornice material. Now, cornice is like what you see in a house. It's the part that goes around the house behind the gutter. It's kind of the trim that goes on where the roof meets the wall. There's a piece of cornice laying on the sand, and it's made out of red granite, and it's curved, it's coped like a scroll. Except it's about 8 feet long, and it weighs about 6 tons. And when you run your hand along it, even though this thing is clearly 5, 6, maybe 7,000 years old, the shape of it, the symmetry of it, is just perfect laying there. Now, this is red granite that's quarried in a mine 300 miles away. It's a piece of trim that goes on a building. Now, that building is no longer there, but it was at one time. I don't know what it went to, but that piece of cornice is sitting there. And we have no idea where the rest of the structure, probably scavenged over the last few millennia. But that piece is a little too big for people to pick up and haul away. It's still sitting there, and it just blows your mind. What the heck is this? And, what was the technology that was used to machine this out of a solid block of red granite?
Yeah, I would love to see it and understand it myself. You know, I think there's some ideas that are close to, we're close to figuring this out, in my opinion, with the work of a lot of people. And I hope hopefully just what I found here can
what I like about what you've done is that you have brought simplicity to the basis of measurement for this. You've looked at it not only as a precision millwork that makes a precision wood, but you've also looked at it like a musician would look at it.
Yes.
As frequency and scales and divisions thereof. And you've created this grid that seems, well, it doesn't seem to, it exactly, repeatedly creates what we once thought a cubit was, what, the measurement from the tip of the king's finger to his elbow or some silly thing like that.
There is a reason for that, but for the actual, I don't mean to interrupt, but the measurement from the elbow of the forearm, which is the length of a cubit as it is divided into his the length of the cubit is the length of the forearm, and then it gets divided into palm, into the palm of the hand, and into digits. And what the length of the arm, the whole point of the hieroglyph being the arm, is that the forearm is a perfect example of the phi ratio. The length of your forearm to your wrist being equal to 1, and then from your wrist to the tip of your finger is 0.618. So that's the arm, the division of the arm in phi ratios would exactly be something to show measure, because all this does relate to phi and these ratios, the Fibonacci sequence and all that. So that is, the forearm is literally, makes sense, you know, because it's divided up into the phi ratio. And then the foot, actually.
Just to make it a little clearer for the listener about how the Fibonacci ratio equates into phi. You know, Fibonacci is figured out a method of increase where you basically start with 0 and add 1 to it to get 1, and then you add 1 and 1 to get 2, and then 1 and 2 to get 3, and you continue on forward. By the time you get out to the numbers, 55 and 89, when you divide 55 into 89, you get 1.618 to 1.
Right.
What we discovered in the book Remembering the Future is a sequence that was first exposed to me by Maureen St. Germain called the Phoenix sequence. Any two numbers added together and then carried forward 8 iterations, you're right back into the golden mean.
Yes.
It's important to know, because this is the ratio that is stable and creative in the universe. Now, it doesn't mean we can't create things that are outside of that ratio. We can. But I'm talking about natural creation. I'm talking about order rising out of chaos by itself, just because of the constructive interference of this ratio 5. So when we think about the creation of universes and what the variety, what the probability is of coming up with a universe that's carbon-based, the probability is 1. It's the only kind of universe that can result. And maybe mankind or humankind, human bodies, are a result of that DNA natural resonance with the universe.
Yes, that's absolutely, you're right, spot on with that. And these ratios are what everything is created from, and how these harmonic resonances of these frequencies are what cause these particles, if you will, or whatever, to form these shapes. And basically, cymatics is a visual way to see how frequency can affect solid matter. Cymatics is basically running the frequency tone into, if you put a speaker underneath a metal cookie sheet and you sprinkled salt or something on that and you played these certain frequencies through the speaker with the salt on top of the cookie sheet, they will form very specific patterns of geometry depending on a frequency. And at some points, the frequencies are completely chaotic, and there's no rhyme or reason. They just bounce around, you know, willy-nilly on the cookie sheet. And at certain frequencies, these harmonic frequencies, all of a sudden, a beautiful order will appear right out of chaos. You'll see this beautiful geometry. You can see it clearly in a lot of the mantra, the Sanskrit stuff that mandala is what I'm trying to get at there.
Right.
You can see, you know, how that, and even the tone of 432 is obviously, you know, really important here with the, you know, that being the Om tone and that sacred number. And it's because at that number, when you square that number, you literally come up with the speed of light. If you square 432, you get 186,624, which is, I know, not exactly the speed of light, but there is rhyme and reason to why that number is used. And there was something written in John Neal's book I mentioned before, All Done with Mirrors, that he puts out there to explain some of this geometry. Maybe if I could find this here, I wouldn't mind reading just a quick note that he put in his book here that really expresses this very well. And that the quote is this: "These ideal expressions may be used for convenient approximations that are easily committed to memory. The tools of metrology or number system are then available to correct the figures to any degree of accuracy." So the 186,624 would be that easy to remember ideal expression, convenient for approximations and easily committed to memory. Then these numbers get broken down by fractions that turn it into more exact and precise measurements.
Interesting stuff. Hey, Ed, let's go ahead and take a quick break right now, get a glass of water, let our affiliates identify themselves, and I'll change tapes, and we'll be ready to go.
Great.
So my guest tonight is Ed Nightingale. His website is thegizatemplate.com. You can find that at xsquaredradio.com. We'll be right back after this, about 4 minutes. Don't go away. More X-Squared Radio coming to you. Talk2X2Radio. We're glad you're here with us tonight, Hour 2. Sorry for the technical difficulties on Hour 1. My guest tonight is Ed Nightingale. His website is thegeethatemplate.com. Good news for those of you that bought the ebook of Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. The book is now out in print, as we promised, and your 25% discount code has been sent to you. All you have to do is click on the button in the email, and it'll take you to a special price version of the book, so you'll get it in print, and we threw in a bonus. You get the audio version for free as a download. So if you're not a great reader, don't worry about it. I read it for you. Special bonus for those of you who bought the ebook while the book was going through the publishing process. For those of you that want to pick up the book, Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, discover how to unlock the secret of the law of attraction. You can go to rememberingthefuturebook.com, click on the links. You can either buy the paperback or the audiobook. If you buy the paperback, you will be receiving the audio version as a bonus. This will be for a limited time as we go through our radio production and publication. As you get ready for the winter, and believe me, it's going to come on strong this year. I know we've had record heat all across the United States. I think we're going to go right through fall, and we're going to jump right into winter. So when that happens, you're going to need a survival kit in your vehicle. So in case you get stranded in a snowstorm or in traffic somewhere, and you need to survive for a day or two, you'll have that with you. You slide off into a snowbank, it's no fun. If you don't even have a candle to keep your car warm, you certainly don't want to run that engine and asphyxiate yourself. We want you to be prepared, so go to 1-800-PREPARE.com, 1-800-PREPARE.com. Our friend Paul Faust, former firefighter and his EMT partner, have formed 1-800-PREPARE.com just for that reason, so that you will have what you need in case of an emergency. Now, we're talking about the metrics that were used to put the pyramids together, but it goes much further than that, much further than that. We're going to share with you some secrets of why the pyramid was built using these frequencies and what it unlocks as we play with the concept of somatics and maybe even show you what effects they have on the rods and cones of the eye. Back in 40 seconds. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming up. Here we go.
Spice extends to life. The spice expands the consciousness. The spice lights right on space travel.
Deep in the mysteries of trying to figure out not only who built the pyramids, why they built them, how they built them, the measurement system may have been discovered by Ed Nightingale. We're just breaking into it now as the experts are still trying to digest his metrics, but so far everything fits together, and it's pretty amazing. There are a lot of measurements about the pyramid. Not only the dimensions, but also the arrangement of the buildings, how they were built in certain order, in a certain location. Ed, one of the things that I wonder about is, as you just sit there in awe, either from the tour bus or as a lone explorer looking at this complex for the first time, if you're an engineer or an artist or if you're an architect or a real estate agent, you have to be amazed about the forethought and even more about the lack of changes in the plan. You think about how long it took to build. You know, we can't finish a city park without four or five engineers changing their mind three times. Just look at how roads change their names as they cross town, and you'll see that. This is a complex that was built from beginning to end with one theme in mind. What impresses you most about this complex?
Well, it's just the craftsmanship. I mean, obviously, it's just stunning to see that there, and you know, to try to understand, you know, why put that much effort into something. You know, the theory behind the egotistical pharaoh, I think, is a flawed one at best. So there had to be a very important reason for them to put this there and spend that much time and effort to sticking with the plan, as you pointed out, that, you know, what could be more important than knowledge? You know, if you're going to survive a cataclysm, you want to do a couple of things. You want to save yourselves, which would be what basically Noah did, or the stories of Noah. There's many stories around the world of the typical deluge situation where someone was told that there was an event coming to build an ark and prepare. Now, at the same time, in my opinion, there also was a great building project going on to house the knowledge, store the knowledge of what we did know. So it could be passed on in the event of some kind of cataclysmic disaster. Just like we're putting in a seed vault in Denmark and doing these things, also to preserve the knowledge of basic mathematics and the understanding of science. It would have to be encoded somewhere so it would last through these times. And I think that's exactly what Giza is all about. And I don't say that that's all that it's about either. I think there's even more facets to it than we're aware of. Not only the measure and information encoded, I think there's actually a physical working, the best word for it, I don't know, maybe machine, I don't know the technical term maybe to use for it, but it functioned, it had a function as well as encoded this information. I do believe that the information encoded will allow to understand the technology of how the thing was built in the beginning, and possibly even when.
Do you think the secrets were taken out of the pyramid? Do you think maybe the Ark of the Covenant was there, and that was the secret?
I do subscribe to something close to that, or that, exactly. What I think's happened here is that this information... And this is just going to be a rough idea here. There's been a lot of work done by others who can show this chain of possession, if you want to call it that. But the knowledge obviously left Egypt at some point. They were obviously going downhill, as we discussed earlier. And I think that the knowledge went from there, ended up in King Solomon's temple, and was basically, along with other treasures, I think the knowledge of this science was also there, and quite possible and probable that the Ark of the Covenant was all part of that. So I think it left Egypt, went to Jerusalem, King Solomon's temple, and later found and discovered by the Knights Templar, who brought this directly to the Vatican or Rome after it was discovered, and they became fabulously wealthy and very powerful after a 9-year visit at Solomon's Temple. And then I think that brings along into the Masonic the Masons having this understanding as well.
I know a lot of Masons, and they're not wealthy, nor do they have any knowledge of how to gain wealth.
Well, I don't think that they, 99.999% of them, have no idea what this is all about, I'm sure.
But well, if you go to Washington, D.C., which I was there a couple of weeks ago, you look at how everything is tied together in these ancient patterns, ancient ratios, symbolisms, and ideas behind how, shall we just say, the roots of the earth, the roots of the universe tie into how governments get their power, retain their power, grow their power. Even though the people really can't make up their minds, elected officials don't have a clue, somehow the power just goes on. And the interesting thing is that the power seems to be above what even government itself can understand, almost as though there's some higher authority up there, or higher authority that's not public, that we don't get to see. Call it dark, call it light, whatever you want to call it. Someone or something is, at least in some sense of the word, making sure that we progress along a certain path. And that may or may not be really great for the human race. It may be great for something else. My original comment was that somewhere around 2.3 million blocks were used to build one pyramid. We're talking about a complex of pyramids that were built over a period of time, and yet no leader's or engineer's ego got in the way of the finished project. Somebody had a master plan of how this was all going to lay out, and like Ed said, there was a reason for designing it this way. And I guess my question to you, Ed, is do you think that the design was for the day and time in which it was built, or do you think it was left for our day to sort of awaken us to what it is we're supposed to be doing right now?
Yes, I think it was left for us today to find this out. That's why it was encoded. If you can imagine a scenario where they knew something was going to happen, where there was a cataclysm approaching, and they wanted to put this down or someplace where we would find it after we were grown back up enough to understand it and utilize this knowledge. You know, you wouldn't want to give a young child, matches to play with. You would... you know, you'd want the matches so he could have fire at some point in his life, but not, you know, not when he's a baby. You know, let him grow up and mature a little bit and then have this knowledge that was important. And I think there's something to the point back. I think it would be, back in the Sumeria, it would be like Enlil and Enki were the ones. Brother was did not want to leave knowledge to the humans or to us, and the other one did, and they kind of were in a disagreement as to whether this knowledge should be left or not, which it obviously was left here, and I believe it was for this time, and actually there's some. There's a calendar that I found encoded within this that I'd really like to get together with Robert Duvall and do a little discussion, because if everything looks like it should, it's looking right now, a little further digging here, I think I could probably bolster Robert Duvall's theory on Orion being part of this arrangement. So, yes, I think it was left for today, and part of the reason of that is based on a calendar that I discovered within, actually points directly to the 2012 time period. They're actually showing the alignment between the center of the galaxy, the sun, and the earth.
Well, that's kind of what I thought, too.
That, yeah.
the way the pyramid was built and what it was aligned to, it's still aligned to after 11,000 years. I wonder at, you know, not maybe the architects, but at least the leaders behind the architects who said, all right, we're going to start in this epicenter of the land masses of the earth. We're going to design this complex. It's going to be mathematically so undeniable that if they have any knowledge of math whatsoever, even prime numbers, even a simple ruler, they're going to be able to figure this out because mathematics is a universal language, and sooner or later somebody smart is going to look at this and go, huh, that's funny. But the idea that they knew something was going to happen as the Earth, or at least the solar system, aligned with this point in the galaxy is quite stunning. They either had a knowledge of the future, or they were given the knowledge from some advanced source that was able to tell them, look, when humanity gets to this point, they're really going to need a clue that they're getting close to this alignment and that somebody went through a heck of a lot of effort to put this icon here to remind them. Now, you know, it's often said it's not the voting that counts so much. It's the counting of the votes that counts. It's not so much the designing of the complex and the complexity and the beauty and the simplicity of the complex. It's the interpretation of the complex in the latter day that really matters.
Yeah.
All of this is in the hands of, in my opinion, and I think you share this opinion, inheritors. And there's a tremendous amount of ego that goes with the inheritors in the sense that they're unwilling to admit that they didn't build it. They don't really know who built it. But that admission to the world would go more toward the bolstering of the current Egyptian leadership's legitimacy in the world than anything else I can think of. How about you?
Yeah. I mean, what is here, if it's really understood and it's true understanding of what was initially put there, I mean, it's going to be huge for Egypt and their culture and really everybody. This is important to everyone. This, you know, anybody who, you know, is living in this time. I mean, this is, I think what they left is our inheritance, and you know, was put there for us to discover at some point. And you know, I think rather than you know, dismissing this as some more pyramid stuff going on, they need to look at this. And you know, I think you've seen enough. There's not a whole lot of arguing the math in this, and they need to look at it and just understand it. You know, this is our legacy, our inheritance, and we need to all get together. You know, I'd love to. The reason I'm putting this out there now, without even having a book or anything else available, is just to share this with other researchers like yourself and many other scholars who dedicated their lives to this. And I think I stumbled into a major piece of the puzzle. I want to share it, and let's all try to figure this out. You know. It really, actually at this point, I'd like to just make a note that early on when I was looking at this whole study here, I was working on symbolism in the beginning, just why they use certain geometry for the symbols in religions and what have you, and it really all ties together. All this... our sacred religious symbols all really tie back to what's left there at Giza and other places as well, not just Giza, but, it's important for Egyptians and everyone else to really look at what we have here. This is pretty major stuff here.
Yeah, it seems that pyramids have been built, you know, all over the planet. They were built here in the U.S., although many of them are quite small and all buried in dirt in Mexico. They get covered in dirt and then grass, and then they just look like hills. But as they're excavated, they're quite stunning in their alignment and in their size. Even though they're constructed in a different manner, they're constructed with mortar and with volcanic rock, the idea of their alignment and their size and their shape and everything is the same. Some of them, if you go further down into Yucatan, are carved out of black granite, which is even harder than the red granite. It's just completely stunning, some of this architecture that's grown up out of the jungles down in Yucatan, or Chichen Itza, or Teotihuacan, these other places. And there are other pyramids that didn't make it. They didn't survive. Some of them are under the sea. Some of them were literally ripped apart by tectonic upheaval. But the idea that they're there, and that the engineering, almost in every case, is so spectacular that you realize that a vast amount of the gross national product of these people were used to build these complexes that really had very little to do with their day. They had mostly to do with our day. And I guess I got to ask you, I think that those races, those times, they really believed in, you know, maybe the spirit surviving the body, and that somehow they would be involved in the last days, in these end times near 2012. They would be involved in bringing those symbols, as it were, mathematics, sounds, back to their level of importance. Don't you think?
That could very well be the case, yes. I wouldn't disagree with that at all. It's strange how things work, you know. It's a possibility, for sure.
How did you, when you say you stumbled across these, shall we call them coincidences, right, that these sound waves, when divided one into another, create these exact measurements going out 3 and 4 decimal places, how did you actually receive this inspiration?
Well, I'll tell you, it really goes back, if I can start the story from the beginning, I guess, would be the best way to explain it to you. But in 1996, I was just going to a millwork shop and had 7 guys working for me, and it was just pretty much of a rat race kind of a deal, you know, just working and focusing on that. And something happened in my life to change my point of view, and so I was always interested in this stuff, and I started looking into religious symbols and different symbolism and the numbers, the sacred numbers. So I studied that for years, and just that inspiration that I was on to something in 1997 when I went to Egypt, I had a clue about the design of it. And I went there and looked, and sure enough, there was something there that spurred me on. And it was just something inside me that said I had to keep going on this. I had to keep digging, and I would read books and books after books to try to learn more, and sometimes go, you know, a year or more without really gaining any ground. And after about 12 years of real digging here and learning, I finally put the compass and straight edge together with a satellite image of the pyramid complex, and just started back engineering it as an architect would draw a blueprint that was as built. In other words, after something, you draw a blueprint to build something, you let the builders build it, then the architect would come back in and do a blueprint as built. In other words, measure exactly what was built. And there would probably be slight variations from what the plan was, but, you know, that's an as-built blueprint. So when I did that, I just, you know, started figuring out this geometry and went into it with a hypothesis that they were leaving some kind of a message here, left in geometry. And as I just kept approaching it from that manner, it all just basically opened right up in front of me. And as far as what really drove me to do it, that's a good question. And what we just discussed earlier might have some relevance, you know. I don't know. It's just, I've always worked with measure and music all my life, and it's just like a natural for me to look into these things. And, fortunately,
Is there a particular sound that seemed to resonate with you, that inspired you?
I'll tell you this little story. Actually, in 1997, when I went over to Egypt, I went with John West. I I'm a songwriter as well, and I had an idea of a song at the time, and it was called Keeper of Time, was the name of the song. And it was literally about going over there and understanding and discovering these secrets. And I wrote the song in the key of F sharp, which at the time I really had no reason why the song was in F sharp. It just happened to be what I thought sounded neat. And as I studied more now and understand, and F sharp is literally octaves higher than the frequency of the Schumann resonance of Earth. I forget how many octaves down it is from F sharp, but it's the same note basically that Earth vibrates. The song happens to be in that key, and so sound. Yeah, I guess when I wrote this song, and it's kind of funny because I wrote it about discovering this, wrote it and recorded it, and here 12, 13 years later, whatever it's been, I literally have some of the answers to those questions that I went over there initially seeking. And, sound was involved with it, so.
Interesting. So, now, the way this resonates, this song, how perhaps it inspired you, how it perhaps gave you a confirmation that you were on the right path, that it looked like things were moving in the right direction because they resonated with you.
Yeah.
When you back engineered this or worked this back to where you came up with these discoveries that really to the third and fourth decimal places that lined up with what this qubit was, did you realize that you had discovered the same thing that the designers of the pyramid had? And how did that inspire you to move forward, to make your case to John West and to others that, hey, I think I've really discovered something, or I think I know where the qubit came from. I think I've got it figured out here.
Yeah, it was, let me tell you, it was a time of being overwhelmed when I first really clicked it together. I can't even explain how overwhelmed I was. You know, I'm just a woodcarver guy, and you know, with an interest in this, and did it on the side as a hobby. And when it actually clicked together, like I said, I was just overwhelmed. And you know, the implications of it were, you know, I knew were going to be extremely controversial and, you know, upset the apple cart, so to speak. So I'd known John, and I called him and talked to him a couple of times and told him I had something, and I don't think he was too sure of it, but eventually he did give in and let me come up and show him this geometry that I had found. And within moments, just a couple of pages, really, of geometry, simple geometry on, he was very impressed and knew that I was on to something. And, of course, I was already well aware that, you know, it was way beyond coincidence that what I had found here, you know. So I knew he knew it was very relevant, and he stood behind me from day one, and, you know, I, it, it was overwhelming. It's still a bit overwhelming. This is really my first interview on this subject. I did present this out at CPAC, the Conference on Ancient Knowledge and Procession, out in San Diego in 2008, which I do believe I met you there, as I recall. It was either that one or 2007. I'm not sure.
But, no, I wasn't out there in 2007. I don't think I've ever...
Yeah, okay, it was in 2007, and I did... I met you briefly. I recognized you and shook your hand, but I don't think we actually exchanged information. But
well, I probably shake so many hands I didn't.
Yeah, right.
It might have been somewhere else. I don't know. What I'm impressed with is the fact that you've tied the wavelength of light, the wavelength of sound, and you've come up with at least what looks to be the route to the measurement system that was used to put the pyramids together.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about that. The numbers are there to, you know, 4 or 5 decimal points out there, and they all perfectly agree. I don't know if you looked at the one that I document that I gave to you that had the actual dimensions of the Pyramid of Khufu given as 440 cubits. If you look at that page where the numbers were all right there.
They're all laid out there.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to... That's the one thing that John was saying, that, you know, it's, the work stands alone. It doesn't need to be backed up by a theory or anything like that. The numbers are there. And very simplistically, you know, put this whole puzzle together. And the music and the measure and the speed of light, and that they're all derived from the speed of light.
Which is interesting, too. Amazing, since ostensibly we're dealing with what history tells us is a Bronze Age people, nomadic in nature, and all of a sudden they park their tents alongside the Nile and decide to build this complex. And now what has been revealed is Sphinx probably predates the pyramids by a good while, at least most of the pyramid complex there. Maybe the Sphinx could be as old as 13,000 years, which would predate the arrival of Noah.
Yeah.
What we have here is we've got a conflict in our historical record.
Oh, yeah.
And when we look at the dynamics of the mathematics, and by that I mean we're talking about precision and accuracy, precision can be likened to tight grouping if you're shooting arrows at a target, and accuracy would mean putting that tight group all in the bullseye. Here we have precision, and we have accuracy. The pyramids are literally built with less than 50 centimeters, that's about 2 inches, of error in a complex that has about 2.3 million blocks in it. I built houses where the block layers were more than 2 inches out in a house that's 30 by 60.
Yeah.
Let alone something the size of the pyramid. It's truly amazing. You realize how much error you'd have on each block laying it to come up with a side that's 440 cubits long.
Yeah.
And only have that amount of error. Now, you can't string a string across the foundation of this because you don't have line of sight. So the idea that you can get it out of square is really easy. I mean, you could get this thing out of square so fast it would make your head spin. By the time you have to, of course, you wouldn't have any idea what you were doing unless you were following a measurement system that was overlaid, well, from the air. There's no way you could do it. You would have to use some kind of measurement system that literally used wavelength to get these blocks laid where they're supposed to be laid. That's the really peculiar thing. How did they get these standing waves to lay across stone in the middle of the daylight using sound, unless they might have used, like you said, semantics, and maybe some kind of sand, laid it out, turned the sound on, watched where the wavelength laid, and laid the next block.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I wish, I hope we can figure this all out, how they did that. But even as far as the dimensions and the accuracy, consider this, that within the template, the Giza template here that I have, it encompasses the circle of it is 6,345 feet in diameter. So you're talking about 1.2 miles in diameter, the circle is. And within that circle, these pyramids are placed in relationship to each other at that kind of accuracy. So forget about, you know, the 756 side of the 56-foot side of the pyramid, not a great pyramid. Consider the fact that, you know, the distance that the pyramids are separated by each other as well. And, you know, how amazing is that? I mean, you know.
And what did Robert say, that they're aligned within 2 arc seconds of the star Sirius?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, how do you do that?
It's astounding. Whoever did this obviously had very high knowledge and understanding of literally the Earth, because all these measurements even tie into the actual size of the Earth. The geological miles, it all breaks down from these root numbers that I'm presenting here. All the measure fits right in there, and including in that measure is, you know, literally the measurement of the Earth to such a high degree that, you know, strings just don't get that kind of accuracy. You know? So obviously whoever did this, you know, had a bit of information on the Earth and its measurements and, you know, where it was placed. And it's amazing. It's just still, I'm in awe sometimes when I look at this thing and just shake my head. I keep trying to find little pieces, you know, put my head into the designers of this thing and try to find more things. And the more I look, the more I find, and it just staggers me, the information that is all put together. If you look at the drawing on my website right at the top of the page there, the Giza template Kia 432, the design there. I mean, within that one square, there is the phi ratio, the angle of pi, the actual angle of the Great Pyramid, and the Fibonacci sequence that in that circle and square that locates the Sphinx. I mean, just the understanding of geometry to have all those components fit that simply, you know, in a circle and a square is amazing. And then how everything fits so neatly into that. I mean, it's just sometimes I sit back and I just can't hardly believe what I'm looking at. You know, it's pretty amazing. Brilliant people.
It's too accidental. It's just too much to be accidental.
Yeah, this is far beyond any kind of coincidence.
Well, where do you go from here? What, with your newfound knowledge, when are you going to be in Egypt now this November?
Well, I'm hoping, actually I was just talking with John West. John West and Robert Schock are currently working on a new Mystery of the Sphinx 2, basically. And they're basing that on some of their findings in Göbekli Tepe in Turkey. These ancient structures are from around the time that they believe the Sphinx was created, so that's kind of bolstering their theory about the age of the Sphinx. But they're going over to start filming on that, and I'm hoping to go along with them and do a little filming of my own for, filming the highlights of the geometry that I've discovered. And hopefully we'll be working with John and Robert. Might have a tidbit of my work in the new upcoming Sphinx documentary. And we hope to proceed after that with a second part of the mystery of the Sphinx that will include this discovery of mine that the plateau was laid out in the geometry and get into that more of that line of the work. So, and I'm working on an e-book. Some of the graphics that I sent you are part of what will be in that e-book. Hopefully, I'm working on hard to try to get it done. It's just a little bit of a difficult thing to write about with geometry. There's a lot of math and pictures in it, so I'm just trying to get that all together and hopefully have that available on my Facebook soon. And a book and DVD and whatever we can do to, I really would like to work with other people on this. There's so much to this. It's far beyond, what I can do myself. There's probably a lot more information encoded in this thing that I have yet to even find. And I think with the fresh eyes of some of the other brilliant guys out there doing good work, we'll be able to take this and run with it. And you yourself, I hope, exposing you to this, you can look at it and get the idea of what's going on here. And it's not only in Giza, I want to add, too. This is tying into Teotihuacan. The Pyramid of the Sun actually has the same base length as the Great Pyramid. And that number is, a significant number in the whole measuring system. So I believe that as I progress here, I'll be able to actually get the same thing from the Teotihuacan pyramid complex. It's essentially encoding the same information that's in Giza, the measure as well as the astronomical knowledge and the calendrical knowledge. And I think that as I progress on this and just have more time to work on it, I'm a working man and I do this on the side here. It's a lot of work to compile all this.
Yeah, you and me both.
So I'm doing the best I can on it. Now that's where we stand at this point. I have an article coming out soon too that I'm working on. It'll be in a local paper here, and then also we're going to get the article out for a little wider distribution to some other magazines and try to get some interest here, and hopefully a little bit of funding, because ultimately what I've done to really prove my case, I guess, in the scientific community, I would need to go over there and do a survey and check these points that I'm making claim to, to see the precision. I mean, I'm very confident in what I got here, and based on the surveys of the Cole survey and even Mark Lehner's survey of the Giza Mapping Project, everything that I've got is working with their numbers, so I'm quite confident of the survey, but that would be something I would like to accomplish. And let's take some funding and hoping to get a little bit of support here for that DVD and get this out there to the public, because this is important to everyone. This is our legacy, and it's not any one person's or any one group of persons. This is for all of us.
I agree. And if you and John and Robert are going to be over there at the same time that I'm going to be over there, I have a small group, 18 mm-hmm. people, and we're going to be sailing the Nile, spending a lot of time at Giza and some of the surrounding areas. And if we're going to be there at the same time, it sounds way too coincidental for us to pass up a chance to get together and maybe compare notes and see what we can come up with. John Riley's going to be with me, a former Skunk Works engineer. between the five of us.
Yeah.
If we can't figure it out, we're going to need some off-world help.
Yeah, there's a, I don't know exactly when they're going over there. They're talking about the schedule today, so I really have no idea. But I know they want to do it soon. So hopefully that would work out. That would be great.
That'd be cool. Well, we're going to be on the Nile sailing on a ship, a small boat, not one of the big cruise ships.
Yeah, Felica,
ships.
Right?
Right. On 11/11. So
cool.
Idea is to be on the Nile, laying on a lawn chair at night, looking at the Milky Way splayed over the top of the Nile.
Yeah. So
that's the plan. Go back about 3,000, 4,000 years and have a look at Egypt. Could be very cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll see what happens. I know John goes over there in November, and whether he's planning to do this with one of his trips and stuff, I'm not sure. But we'll keep in touch, and we'll see how that works out. It'd be great.
Yeah, please do. I mean, John hasn't been on my program, but Robert's been on a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
And, we always have great conversations.
He's a great guy. Great guy. Very brilliant guy.
Very well connected over there. I am not connected at all over there. I'm a nobody over there, and I prefer to stay that way.
Yeah.
I don't publish on the pyramids. We wrote a little bit about them in our first three books of the Ark of Millions of Years series, but we don't speculate. We're not meant to stir up the dust, as it were. What we're trying to do is open people's minds and get them to realize that perhaps the human race is a little bit more than what we've been led to believe.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Writings. Maybe we're involved a little deeper in the galaxy than what the average person would agree to. When we look at the Earth and the complexity of it and the complexes that are built upon the Earth, supposedly by primitive people, it really convinces me, and it convinces the people that listen to this program and that read our books, that there's something more to it than meets the eye.
Yeah, I couldn't agree anymore. It certainly is. And I think, you know, that, like I said, that working together with this new information, and I hope we can really get some serious answers to these questions. And I think it's high time. I mean, with what's going on in the world today, I think we need to figure a few things out. And,
yeah, it is kind of interesting to see the political talking heads, and really even the. Those that are in control of the antiquities, those talking heads too, come up with their ideas of, you know, what it is the Earth should be and how they're trying to control all the powers that are on the Earth and whether they're even controllable. It's kind of interesting that we've arrived in this place with instant communication around the planet and we've got all this knowledge and just barely enough wisdom to go with it.
Yeah, that's the scary part, yeah, not having the wisdom and the maturity. And, that's what one of the things that concerns me, you know. I hope that we're grown up enough to be able to handle all this and use it appropriately and to better humanity, not to inflate it, which I think is what's being done now, quite frankly. But
I think as long as we're out there, you know, thinking and talking and exploring and then letting the world know what we found, I think there's hope.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah, I'm very hopeful. I'm here doing this. If I didn't think there was any hope, I wouldn't be here doing it.
Well, your foot is on the path, my friend, and that is the destination.
Well, I'm there with a lot of other people, you know, and trying to do my part, you know.
Excellent. I look forward to meeting you, actually. I think our paths are going to cross before too long.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear you there.
I said I'm looking forward to meeting you. I think our paths are going to cross.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I listened to your show when we carved during work. We always listened to shows like yours, and you know, I figured you would be a guy that would understand what I'm talking about here, and you know, to get to come out of the gates with someone with some science background here that can look at this stuff and see the validity of it, and hopefully we can, you know, move forward from that and really get this out there. This I really believe is extremely important, and a lot of people need to see this.
Yep, I totally agree. There's something about getting sawdust in the cuffs of your pants that will just inspire you. I don't know what it is. Working with wood, building stuff from the life of the earth with your own hands is really something. One of my most favorite things to do is to go out to the job site and the very first turning of the dirt to actually lay the foundation.
Yeah.
There's a smell, there's an energy about preparing the ground to raise a building.
Yeah.
And then you come back in a few months and there's a building there that you built with your hands. That is really satisfying.
Yes, it is. And I've been fortunate enough actually to work completely through that whole building process right from as a young man starting to working in a lumber yard, actually delivering the lumber, and working with a contractor and learning how to lay out the house, where it's going to go, you know, to make the foundation. And over the years, you know, worked up to the point now where I'm a wood carver and a woodworker who's doing the finishing touches on these houses. And it's very rewarding. And, you know, just as a craftsman, dealing with the tolerances that we work with in my trade, you know, I can look at this, you know, this edifice in stone over there, and it's just, you know, it's breathtaking. I mean, I can't believe that, you know, that some of these people actually try to downplay the, you know, the difficulty of constructing something like that. You know, telling me they can do this with copper chisels, you know, I got a problem with that, you know.
Well, they're just trying to fit it into, you know, what they're
right. Yeah, I understand that. I definitely understand why they're doing it, because they don't have any other answers.
Well, if they go back before their calendar, their people being there, then, well, they're not involved.
Right.
That just won't do. You know? Of course we were involved.
Yeah.
Well.
So, you know, I think it's just important that the truth be known, you know, and that's all I'm looking for here, the truth. You know, that's been my goal here for 13, 14 years working on this project. And, you know, I've even had to change my ideas along the path because they didn't fit the evidence. You know, so I've kind of just rolled along following the evidence. And to date, this is what I've got, and I think it's significant.
Yeah, it's important that we don't jump to conclusions and force our own interpretation upon the evidence. Let the evidence unfold, and that's what you've done. I think you've really done what some of the great egos couldn't do because they jumped
because of their ego. That's exactly it. Believe me, when I started the whole idea here, I was way off base on a few things, and it was hard to admit that. You know, it was like, and I just said, well, it's wrong, and I just kept working away, and then, you know, maybe a year or 2 years later, all of a sudden, the reason, you know, I was wrong in this one point, all of a sudden, developed into something, while I wasn't maybe quite wrong, but I was looking at it correctly, and this is what it was, you know, and boy, you know, it's obviously worked, because and just following the evidence, I compiled a bit of it, and I got to tell you, I showed you a very small part of what I actually had. It's really just involved with where this geometry is used in symbolism, and it's very telling. When you look at certain symbols, it's very hard to argue the fact that they we're not using the same geometry that I found here, you know. So, like I said, this is just a small part of what I found. I think there's a calendar in there, and that really, you know, just more stuff that needs to come out and will be out in this book, hopefully at some point, and I'll get a little bit of help putting this all together, and should be quite an interesting ride.
Well, that's good. We commend you for your work, and we encourage you.
Great.
And if there's anything we can do to help publicize it, you be sure to let us know.
Oh, I sure will. Yeah, I appreciate you doing this interview with me and letting me show you my work.
Hey, it's no problem. Many people will go to work tomorrow morning, load up the archives to X Squared Radio. Believe me, they're working on their own carvings or their own blueprints or whatever, and they put the headphones on and they listen to this interview, and they'll be on to you as well. They'll be looking for your work when it comes out.
Well, I hope so. And, you know, the one thing nice about this work, too, is that, you know, the people can look at this, and I'm sure there's more there to discover. This is kind of a map, and, you know, as more eyes get looking at it, I'm sure there's more there to pick out. So, you know, with all these armchair archaeologists out there that are looking for a little something to entertain themselves with, you know, to have a look at this, and you never know, different fresh eyes might very well pick out some very important pieces to this puzzle.
Well, who knows? You might discover the musical harmonies that unlock it all.
Well, based on what I found here so far, I think that you're probably very close to stating what I think is there. You know, I think it literally is there.
Excellent. Well, we appreciate you coming on the program, Ed.
Great.
Ed Nightingale's been my guest. His website is thegizatemplate.com. His information is posted at xsquaredradio.com under the Archives September. If you're not an Archives subscriber, I suggest you become one. And if your subscription is about to expire, renew it, because we always have great guests on X Squared Radio, and we do our best to do the best interview that we can. I think we've done very well in getting into Ed's technology here. Very soon, I think he's going to have a book out, or at least an article, or a pamphlet, or a brochure, or a white paper. And if we can, we'll have him back on. Maybe we'll have him on with John Schock, or we'll have him on with Robert Balval. And it could be a very interesting program.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
If we make that discovery in November or December, we'll have you back on.
That'd be great. I would look forward to that very much.
Excellent. I've had a good time.
Oh, me too. Brooks, I really appreciate again you having me on.
All right. That's it for that segment, Earth Explorers. We'll take a quick break, about 3 minutes, and then we've got about 25, 30 minutes left. I need to polish off some things. We'll be back after this short break. A little bit of Alchemist from Enigma. We'll be right back with more X Squared Radio. Don't go away. Thank you. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. We've got about 25 minutes left. I wanted to let you know that next week we're going to have a pre-recorded session. The reason we're going to do that is because we're going to bring Nigel Turner, John Biggerstaff, PhD, and also Andrew Silverman on the program. We're going to be discussing transformation of our natural humanity into an artificial version of features. Nigel Turner recently contributed to a scientific conference in Frascati, timed with the recent exposition of the Shroud of Turin. And Dr. Andrew Silverman, a medical doctor, presented Nigel's ideas at the conference on how the image may have been formed to an audience of world experts on the study of the Shroud. It is Nigel's thesis that the Shroud of Turin is the most powerful illustration paradigm to show the power over atoms of someone who lived for existence beyond the atomic state. The example of such a life may well be the antidote to anything the Greys might have brought to us. So it's going to be an interesting program. I don't want you to miss it. We're going to pre-record it on Thursday of this week because of the schedule of these three experts. And then we'll play it for the 3 hours next week during the program. So you won't be able to call in next week. We don't normally do this. In fact, I don't think we've ever done this unless we've run an archive. But in order to meet the schedule of these three experts, John Biggerstaff is a PhD in cell biology and biochemistry from Brunel University in the UK, and also Andrew Silverman is a medical doctor who has been helping Nigel get his theories out there. We're going to have all three men on the phone. This has all been coordinated with Daniel Silverman, and they're over in the UK, so in order to accommodate their time schedule, we're going to shift things and talk about that next week on the program. We also wanted to let you know that the elections are coming up, and we want you to pay close attention because there, you know, oftentimes we think that we don't really have an effect on the planet. We don't really have an effect on what is going on with the United States of America, with our government. We feel so small, one of 300 million, not really involved that deeply in the voting process, except maybe going to the polls and casting one vote out of many. But I can tell you that nothing could be further from the truth. There are competitors for the bounty that you all are generating with your innovation, with your skill, with your work levels, and they are doing their best to access that checkbook and have their way with it. Now, one of the things you might have noticed if you look at commerce as it has been, has literally come to a standstill in the last 24 months. Yes, you know, Walmart's still doing well, all the retail outlets, restaurants, et cetera, gas stations, of course. But we're talking about the capital of business. We're talking about the money that makes business start up. And that has not been moving at all. There are perhaps multiples of trillions of dollars that are just sitting there earning interest. They're not moving. We don't really know why. We don't know if it's in protest. We don't know if it's in fear. We don't know if it's a move of security. We'd rather get 1% on something than take a risk on anything because we don't know what's going to happen. Or maybe there are signals deep in the economy that only the very wealthy have access to. We just don't have access to it. We don't know what's going on. We're trying to preserve our little corner of the universe, make sure that it doesn't collapse, make sure we can make our house payment, our car payment, or whatever medical bills we have to make without losing our job or going bankruptcy. Those that own small businesses have as many people working for them as they can possibly stand, and they're not going to hire anybody else. unless more orders come into the door. And the only way orders are going to come into the door is if more people go to work. Because if more people go to work, then they get a paycheck, then they go in those places, they can order what those places make. I don't care if it's furniture, shoes, cars, books, movies, computers, whatever it is, people have to have a job. They have to be working. And that's how you get capital moving. And the only way to get these people working, let me reverse myself here. The wrong way to get these people moving is to extend more credit to people. That's not the way to do it. To go attack the banks and tell the banks you've got to loan money to these people so they can go out and buy at Walmart and Best Buy and the mall is the wrong way to get things moving. The right way to get things moving is to free up capital so that those people with ideas that are trying to start businesses that need people to work at those businesses can get access to that capital. The only way to gain access to that capital is to make sure to encourage those investors and those banks and those investment banks to free up their money and let it flow again. Let it go to work in the community. Right now, it's not working. You understand me? It's not working. That means that however we cast our votes in the last election in 2008, it didn't work. Whatever marketing campaign you submitted yourself to, whatever influenced you to pull the handles that you did, it was the wrong combination. Something went wrong. Yes, you heard a lot of press. Yes, you heard some great marketing ideas from the White House and from others of perhaps, political parties or bureaucratic agencies. But it didn't happen. Okay? $2 million for each job created during the stimulus is not effective. You understand what I'm saying? You could have just given the money away and gotten further than what you got. And we have to stop this cycle. And we've got to stop it very quickly because we are digging our nation into a hole we cannot get out of. There is not enough money to get out of it. There's not enough earning power to get out of it. And I know you're thinking that 9.2 or 9.3 or 9.6% unemployment is just normal. But it isn't. And there are areas of the country where this unemployment rate is not 9%. It's 20%. 1 in 5 people do not have a job. Do you understand what that means? They don't have enough to pay rent. They don't have enough to buy food. They don't have enough to buy a home or a car or buy gasoline. They don't have enough for an education. They don't have enough for health care. This is a level of poverty we have not seen since the Great Depression, when the middle class completely evaporated in the noonday sun. We had the impoverished and we had billionaires. There was no one in between. We cannot go back there. We have too much population to go back there. In 1929, we weathered it, barely. In 2011, we won't do it. You have to go to the polls and you have to vote to get us out of this mess. We've got to take it back. We cannot go down the same path of giving all the money that comes through government from our paychecks to the wealthiest corporations. It can't be done. The bailouts have to stop. That money has got to go back to companies that are trying to form businesses, small businesses, 20, 30, 50, 100, 200 employees. That's where the money has to go, people. If it doesn't go there, you're not going to have a job. Your neighbor's not going to have a job. And if your neighbor doesn't have a job, he's not going to be able to buy what you make. I don't care if you sell shoes, if you write computer programs, if you cut hair, if you sell groceries. It isn't going to work. We've got to change course. Okay? So, you've got to stay aware. You have to listen. And don't fall for these slick marketing programs. Find out what the politician's platform is. Stay well informed. And move forward. Not the status quo. If we have to fire all 435 up there in Washington, then let's do it. Look at the old guard that's sitting there and see which way they're dragging us down the highway. We're tired of it. Time to take the country back, my friends. We can do it if we work together. Now, let me bring you up to date on a couple things. The Egypt trip that happens on November 8th, we have a couple seats left. I think we might have 4 seats left. There are those of you listening to this program, some of you live, some of you will listen to this as an archive on the week of the 27th of September. If you feel a calling that it's your time to go to Egypt, believe me, you couldn't pick a better group of people to go with. This is a small group, 18 people. We will be sailing on the Nile on a small ship that was custom built for this kind of voyaging. We're not talking a big cruise ship with 400 or 500 people on it. We're talking 18, which means we can go with a different schedule. We stop at some of the islands, and you will see a stage of Egypt that hasn't been seen in thousands of years. You will be sailing the Nile at night, laying on a lawn chair on the roof of the boat, and you can see the Nile splayed out underneath, and to either side of you underneath the Milky Way. We're going in an auspicious time of 11-11. We're going to be going to places you've always wanted to go, not as a big tour bus going to the pyramids, privately, private time in the pyramid, private time in the temple of Edfu. We're going to be going to Damanhur, a city out in the desert that has not been visited by the West. John Riley opened this portal a year ago. I was there when he left. I was there when he came back. I can tell you that you're going to see things no Westerner has seen. You will photograph things your friends have not seen and will never see. If you feel a calling to go to Egypt, this is the answer. Now, this is a once-in-a-lifetime trip. So if you feel like you don't want to spend $4,000 or $5,000 to go to Egypt because it's too much money, don't think about it on a one-year scale. Think about it on a 3 to 5 year scale. If you were to go to this point on the planet as an explorer, not as a tourist, take your own photos, make your own movies, make your own thoughts and your own theories about what you're going to see with John Riley and myself. Now spread the cost of that out over that time period and see how special it can be. There are 4 places left. If you feel a calling, I need you to get a hold of me as quickly as you can. Click on the 1111 Gateway Mystery School link at X Squared Radio. Call us up and let's get your information and get this started. We can very quickly get your visa, get all your travel arrangements made, all your meals, everything is covered inside the cost, all right? The only thing you need to do is get yourself to Cairo and back, and right now the air passage is cheap. You go through Amsterdam, you go through Paris, if you want to stay an extra day in either one of those places, you're fully free to do that. But we are going to go to the ancient cities, and you are going to go with us. If you feel that calling, click on the banner at X Squared Radio and get back with us. We appreciate you being part of X Squared Radio. Without you, we couldn't stay on the air. We're coming up on our 1,000th hour on the air with BBS Radio. We're proud members of BBS Radio, been here since 2005. And we will carry on. So please be good. Do what you do each week. And look for the good in others. And we will see you next week right here
on X Squared Radio.
It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.